The following program was made possible by grants from the New Jersey Committee for the Humanities through the National Endowment for the Humanities and the New Jersey Historical Commission.
It is 1939. In Europe, Hitler has invaded Czechoslovakia and is attacking Poland. In America, the war and prosperity lie beyond the horizon. 10 years after the great crash, FDR continues to provide jobs through the Works Projects Administration. Thousands of WPA workers, issued picks and shovels, are off building America. New parks, roads, bridges.
Where were you born?
In the old country.
But other WPA workers with pen and paper are off listening to America, interviewing ordinary people, building an oral history of the country for the New Deal. One WPA writer's project is called the Ethnic Survey. Across the nation, field workers drafted from the rolls of the unemployed hear the life stories of immigrants who came to America in the 19th and early 20th centuries, also the recollections of their children and grandchildren. In the state of New Jersey, the WPA field workers visit the Irish, Poles, Lithuanians, Russians, Dutch, Ukrainians, the Italians, the Jews, mostly in the cities of Paterson and Newark. What we are about to hear are individual stories, but they are part of a collective transformation of old social networks adapting to a new world. Now, part one of America, the Dream of My Life, the Unbroken Chain.
Mother and father came over in a sailing vessel. I don't know how long it took them. Gollies, I can't tell you when they came over here. It's before the Civil War, after the big wind.
Do you know the year?
The big wind, 1839, off the Irish coast.
The ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, 10 miles west of New York City. It used to be known simply as Down Neck. The neighborhood sits on a narrow neck of land between the Passaic River and the Newark salt marshes.
Did your father serve in the Civil War?
No, father was too young to go to war. He went into business, married, brought up a family, served a term in the legislature. He refused to serve a second time, he told him. You almost made a crook out of me the first time, so I don't want to serve a second time.
This was a good country till the politicians got a hold of it and put it on the bum.
By 1860, 62,000 Irish have settled in New Jersey. Newark, an agricultural town in colonial days, had become a city of immigrants and industries, the country's leading leather-producing center. Newark also manufactured carriages, as well as jewelry and beer. The Germans owned many of the breweries. The Irish owned many of the saloons.
What was this district like when your father came here?
Irish and German. I remember, there wasn't an Italian in it, this side of the railroad. There was only four families of Jews. Since my father came here, we have every nationality in the face of the earth. Everyone. The only lights they had were lampposts. Gas. The lamplighter used to go around with matches. He had to climb each lamppost before he got smart enough to use a long light.
I started off to work for a quarter a week, lighting lampposts, remember that? In the old Sixth Ward. I wound up as a bartender, and I'm still a bartender.
I wish I had those days over again. We used to go swimming in the Passaic River with our birthday suits. Ah, the old Down Neck. And the Irish and Germans were here. It was the best place in New Jersey. In the blizzard of 88, we walked on the snow and looked into the second-story windows and all the houses on Market Street. Where the steelworks are, we'd have ice skating 31 nights straight, with the moon shining every night when I was a kid.
I was born the year of the big blizzard. In my hometown, Nashville, Tennessee, the snow was up to people's necks. My father died when I was 3 months old. and I was raised in an orphan asylum until I was 10. Then I went to work in a bucket factory to support my mother. I was 12 years old then. Then I quit the bucket factory and went to work for the Western Union and the Postal Service. I worked part-time in each one. At 16, I left home and began working in boiler shops, wherever I could find work. I rode freight trains all over the country. In Newark, I went in the steeplejack business for myself, and I've been working in that business of fixing smokestacks 18 years. I had two falls. One fall was 100 feet. I fell off the smokestack at Napta Hat Works. After being laid up for 3 months, I had a job at Hale in New Jersey for the Manley Pierce Dye Works, and I fell 50 feet off a stack. Yet I have no defects from either fall. Now I find it hard to get a job. I have to take work as a watchman on WPA.
The guy that has steady employment doesn't know what's going on. This country's all right, but right now there isn't an opportunity to make a living. Lots of us fellas have it awful tough. It's a feast and a famine. You have a chance to get your head above water, and then you sink again. Now, when the emigration boom was on, thousands went to Canada, a couple went to Australia, and some went to all parts of the world. You get the fever too. You leave. Sometimes you give up a good home. I'm a lone wolf since the Depression. I'm only here by myself. Nobody belongs to me.
The Irish who immigrated to America are not a monolithic group. Many who came before the famine of 1845 have become middle-class business owners. The famine refugees tended to be of a poorer class, illiterate, unchurched. But by the turn of the century, the transplantation to American soil has created something new and homogeneous. An Irish American who, for the most part, embraces the Democratic Party, the Catholic Church, Irish nationalism, and the labor movement.
I put in over 18 years for a concern in Downneck. I was laid off on holiday time. The reason given was to reduce expenses. I put in 20 years and 2 months for a concern in this same neighborhood, gave them more than was required of me, and was handed a check for 2 weeks' salary and let go without any rhyme or reason. That's the absolute truth. I know people who have worse experiences than I did. I know people who worked for 50 years who helped them make their money and were fired.
I am a union man and proud of it. I'd rather go in relief instead of taking low wages. I'd always stick by the union and the Irish.
My father was a union man. He belonged to the Knights of Labor. Before the union came in, my father worked for $9 a week, and he had to do stable work with horses on Sundays. When the Knights of Labor came in, there was no Sunday work, and the wages were raised to $15 a week and the hours reduced.
Where were you born?
In the old country. I was almost 13 when I came to this country. I haven't got much to say except that this country is all right. In those days, children went to work young. Today, they can't go to work until they're 18. 50 years ago, I recall a young Irish woman of 9 years of age worked in the Sandford Mills from 6 in the morning till 6 at night. I heard of her death just a little while ago. Women built up that mill.
In 1939, when WPA field workers began their ethnic survey, about 35,000 Poles were living in Newark. The Poles came za chlebem, for bread. Most were laborers, but as far back as the 1800s, a distinct immigrant middle class developed. Often these Polish-American business people functioned as agents for their inexperienced countrymen and women. They translated letters, arranged steamship tickets, extended credit, found housing. It has been said that the Poles had no system of ethnic labor brokering. However, descriptions of Polish boarding houses and employment agencies heard by WPA field workers in the ethnic survey suggest the opposite.
In the early days, almost every Polish family had 2 to 5 boarders. One boarding house consisted of 3 rooms and housed 23 people. One half of the boarders worked nights, one half days. The men of the night shift occupied the beds in the daytime that the men in the day shift slept on at night.
In the year 1888, Mr. Walter Duckett, who had come from Freistadt, Austrian Poland, a year previous, started a boarding house and meeting hall at 30 South Orange Avenue. There were 18 rooms in Mr. Duckett's boarding house. 11 were occupied by families, and the other 7 occupied by boarders, 3 or 4 men to a single room. Mr. Duckett had 2 sinks in the boarding house, and there were long lines waiting for a pitcher of water to bring to their rooms. Many times people would wash in the same water instead of going for fresh water. A few of the more expensive rooms had gas lamps, but most of them had oil lamps. The rates were $1 or $2 a week.
I first came to Pennsylvania, moved to Newark in 1912, worked as a laborer in a foundries and a steel mills. In Pennsylvania, most Poles were mine workers. Some were organized in the trade unions, but very few were skilled workers.
Is there discrimination against Poles?
A lot depended on for who you worked and where. In the organized shops, everyone was treated alike. I worked in Ford from 1921 to 1925. There were lots of orders then, and they didn't care who they hired. Today, things are different.
Nineteenth-century Jewish immigration happened in 2 distinct phases. The German Jews began arriving in the 1840s. Many settled in the neighborhood of Springfield and Belmont Avenues, which became known as Schmierkäse country, a reference to the farmers' cheese they ate. The German Jews founded tanneries, became cigar makers, jewelers, and tailors. Still, in the 1860s, there were only about 200 Jewish families in Newark. Beginning in 1880, the Eastern European Jews began to come. In large part, they were fleeing pogroms, or anti-Jewish riots. By 1907, 35,000 Jews lived in Newark. More came as a result of World War I, including Miss Schimmel.
In 1918, when the war ended and mail was able to pass freely from the United States and the Central Powers, Miss Schimmel wrote to an uncle and asked him to bring her to the United States. At no time did her uncle wish to do it, but as perseverance will in time wear away the most stubborn refusals, in 1923 she was sent for. During this exchange of letters, she learned about the whereabouts and plight of her family. Her father had died the previous year, but she was in no condition then to aid her family. Miss Schimmel was brought here in second-class passage. The trip took 12 days. She says that each day was happier than the preceding because she knew that she was that much closer to the promised land. She arrived in New York on a Tuesday in May. She was checked out at Ellis Island and immediately went to her uncle's home. That night, her aunt took her to the Turkish hot baths to clean her up from her long trip. After 2 weeks of inactivity, she got a job in a handkerchief factory. She earned $10 per week, the prevailing wage for beginners in this trade. She got this job through her aunt. During this time, she went to social affairs. She hoped to meet some eligible young man, but it was to no avail. 3 years ago, she lost this job because of the Depression. She has had to live in a downtown section of town where the rent is low. As you can readily see from the above information, at no time was she fixed financially so as not to worry about her job. She keeps the Orthodox Jewish faith, but she attends the synagogue only during the high holidays. She expressed deep sympathy for her 2 sisters and her brother and sister-in-law, who are still in Poland.
Immigration is the story of individuals, but it is also a collective transformation. Through letters from friends and relatives already in America, immigrants learned of destinations where they might settle. And except in rare cases, they joined family already established in ethnic enclaves. What's more, in those enclaves, wholesale assimilation into American ways did not occur. A subtler metamorphosis took place with strong links to the past. Immigration was an unbroken chain. Nowhere was this process of transplantation and change better exemplified than within the Jewish experience in Paterson, New Jersey, once the silk-producing capital of the country.
The interviewee was born in the city of Lodz, Poland, which was a very large textile center. Up until the time of leaving Lodz, he had corresponded with some friends and relations in Paterson. They had written him that he could secure work in silk mills because of his experience in the woolen mills of Lodz. A great many Jews were the owners of grocery and candy stores throughout the city. The clothing stores on Main and Market Streets and on Broadway were owned by the German Jews, who lived in the East Side section of Paterson. Most of the Jews, about 75% of them, earned their living by working in the silk mills. In this country, they dropped a great many of their religious customs. Saturday was not a special day anymore, far different than in the old country. Here, they were forced to work in order to keep their jobs. Saturday noon was payday, which gave them a chance to do their shopping. In his 30 years as a weaver in Paterson, he worked under about 25 different bosses. He quit his job because of arguments with his boss, or poor quality silk, or lack of light. He never knew any other trade, so he just drifted along in silk.
American patterns of work put pressure on the traditional culture, but the WPA field workers found the Jews maintaining old social networks and creating new institutions as well. Like other immigrants, they formed self-help groups, in their case, Landsmannschaften, or hometown associations. These groups provided life insurance, arranged burials, set up charities to help the less fortunate, provided social connections like those in the old country.
The Polish Jews had their own groups named after the cities from where they came in Poland. The Jewish peddlers, clothing and junk dealers, lived on the north side of the river, mostly on Water Street, where they had their own synagogue, which was called the Junkman's Shul. The Polish Jews stuck together, especially the lodgers. They had their own society, and at their annual ball in the Hebrew Free School, they had a very enjoyable time, meeting with many of their former friends from Lodz. Many of them had received letters from home, and their friends were always interested in reading these letters. On most of these occasions, they would have a person who had recently come from Lodz go up on the platform and say a few words about conditions back home. Many of the people would ask questions about their friends and families in Lodz. This same good time was had at their annual picnic, which was held out in the parks during summertime.
There were many Jewish lodges whose main ideas were to give the Jew a decent burial and provide the family of the departed with a small sum of money.
St. Anthony's Parish Church, a small frame structure built 37 years ago, is the principal social agency in this little Italy called Silver Lake. Today, a new and much larger church is being erected to improve the facilities of the older building. When Italian immigrants from the native town or region first arrived here, they formed societies and clubs among themselves. These societies were usually named after the member's native town or after the town's patron saint. They exert a powerful influence on the individual by providing him with religious, social, and cultural outlets. Some of the more outstanding societies are Holy Name Society, St. Bartholomew, St. Gerard, La Madonna Addolorata, and Fili d'Italia.
Between 1899 and 1910, a span of just 11 years, more than 2 million Italians arrived in the United States. 8 of 10 from Italy's southern provinces. About half were to return to Italy, at least for a time, after saving as much money as they could from wages in the United States. Those who stayed settled mostly in New England, New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. Newark became a major destination. The city was in a building boom. The men found jobs in construction, with a gas and electric company, and the railroad. Single women worked as homemakers in small family-owned shops and boarding houses. As with the Poles, a few Italians moved up to the middle class by providing services to new immigrants. Often the new Italian immigrants depended on a padrone or labor agent to find them jobs and handle their money. The padrone understood the American system of work, knew the employers, and spoke both Italian and English.
I was born August 14, 1872, in the small village of Aretrina in the province of Campobasso, Italy, the third child of a large family of nine children. One day my uncle wrote us how everything was much better in America. Father didn't care to come to America. I asked my parents about my going, and they consented. I was 15 years of age. I kissed my father and mother and the rest goodbye. That was February 1887. I didn't know at the time, but it was the last I ever saw of my mother and father. 4 days after my arrival, my uncle secured a job for me on the Erie Railroad as a laborer in track repair at $6.25 per week. As time went on, I became assistant boss on the railroad. I suddenly found myself very popular and in demand by my fellow workers and countrymen, which at first I could not quite understand. But not long after, I fully understood, so much so that it started me thinking. During the course of our working day, there were many occasions for various men to call on me in reference to work, and they would almost always address me as padrone. It got so that in about a year, I really was padrone this and padrone that. I became quite a leader among our entire Italian group, for so many had come to me for employment. Fortunately, I had been able to secure work for them, so that it further increased my countrymen's esteem for me. Well, conditions being what they were, most of my countrymen soon were entrusting to my care all of their savings, and not expecting any interest in return. I, in turn, invested in real estate and deposited in various banks all of their savings and mine, too. I enjoyed their faith so that I was respected as a father in general, and I also arranged and promoted a number of matrimonies. I selected and bought all necessary furnishings for such an occasion. Then, too, as time went on, some of my boarders, having saved quite a lot of money, I would induce them to buy a small home, which I would sell them, for I had acquired 7 or 8 of them. The World War was the beginning of the end of my enterprise, for everyone was making a lot of money, and with that, they all seemed to scatter. Some went to war, and some went to work in the shipyards and ammunition factories, and they didn't need me anymore. However, I take pride in one fact, that most of all that could come back to me have come many times, and I feel that I have served and helped them well.
Scholars warn us about oral history. As documentation, it has many hazards. Sometimes, life stories can be self-serving, inaccurate. Nonetheless, taken in the context of other documents, oral histories are an important resource. These narratives in particular, because they support a revised view of immigration. An earlier generation of historians saw immigrants as the uprooted, people disconnected from their peasant origins. Today, a new generation of scholars sees immigrants as part of a transplanted social system. Rather than a process of shock and assimilation for families, Immigration was a continuous, collective transformation where social networks from abroad produced new networks and institutions in a new world.
Ireland is still beautiful. They will never be able to drain the lakes of Killarney nor the River Shannon. I've been to Paris, Bordeaux, Marseille, New York, Chicago. I still think Dublin is the most beautiful city of them all.
You have been listening to The Unbroken Chain, based on interviews of immigrants and their families conducted by the WPA Writers Project Ethnic Survey from 1939 to 41. The Unbroken Chain was a co-production of the New Jersey Historical Commission and public radio station WBGO. It was narrated by Eli Wallach. The program is based on the book America the Dream of My Life by David Stephen Cohen, published by Rutgers University Press, and was made possible by grants from the New Jersey Committee for the Humanities through the National Endowment for the Humanities and the New Jersey Historical Commission. Consultants included John Bodner, Gerald Hirsch, Barbara Kirshenblatt-Kindlett, and Virginia Yance McLaughlin. The views expressed in it are not necessarily those of the New Jersey Historical Commission, WBGO, or the New Jersey Committee for the Humanities. Heard on today's broadcast, Deborah Allison, Eleanor Basescu, Pauline Flanagan, Ralph Fryer, Sam Gray, John Layton, Dermot McNamara, Chris O'Neill, Dennis O'Neill, Kieran O'Reilly, and Andrei Vishalevich. The recording engineers were Karen Perlman and Leszek Wojcik. Tape editor, John Kalish. Mixing engineer, David Rapkin. The Unbroken Chain was directed by Charles Potter. It was written and produced by Marty Goldenson. The executive producer was David Stephen Cohen.